Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation cited the current and emerging treatment landscape of metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, or mHSPC. I'm Dr. Jack Andrews. I'm a urologic oncologist at Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona.
And I'm Dr. Eugene Cohn. I'm a urologic oncologist and the co-director of research at Urology of Indiana in Greenwood, Indiana.
And I am Arash Rezazadeh. I'm a medical oncologist specializing in GU oncology and currently working at University of California, Irvine.
Well, the therapeutic landscape for metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer is rapidly advancing with new clinical evidence and treatment options emerging. This MedCast series examines the latest developments in patient care, from innovative combination approaches to emerging clinical trial data. So join us as we explore evidence-based strategies for treatment selection, the role of different therapeutic combinations, and approaches to personalizing care for patients with mHSPC. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
So, Dr. Rezazadeh, when do patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer typically present in your practice?
Well, I have a wide variety of patients coming from community setting with very high PSA, high volume disease, or actually patients that have been taken care of in our institution after prostatectomy or radiation, but have been followed over time and the PSA relapse could be low volume or high volume. They really have all kind of different presentation in my practice.
What type of workup is typically done before they get to you? You know, at that first visit, what information do you typically have available?
It depends. Most of the time patients have a CT scan, maybe not necessarily a bone scan or a PSMA scan. If they are followed by urologists, they normally get a bone scan and send it my way. But they have some sort of imaging, maybe 20%, 25% of the time, they just have PSA progression and come my way right away.
Yeah, and we're seeing obviously more and more of the role of PSMA PET expanding. I think it'd be interesting to know in patients who present only with conventional imaging, how often are you restaging them with PSMA PET imaging?
Yeah, I usually use PSMA PET imaging as one of the primary workups that I get for the patients. I think it's a very good tool to have, but we have to remember that it can have false positive, for example, liver lesions for patients who have Gleason 9, 10, and low PSA, for example, or false positive. Like I see a lot of rib lesions that are not real. The patient comes with a low PSA and only one rib lesion, and the patient had 3 + 4 prostatectomy samples. So you have to put it in context and think about each case. But overall, good sensitivity, good specificity, and we use a lot of PSMA PET. Where it really falls short for me is where we restage the patient with PSMA scan and trying to figure out what it means. Is that a response? How long we have to wait for the to SUV to go down or become negative? That's a sort of challenge. But to answer your question, for primary staging, I use a lot of PSMA PET scan.
That's a good point. PSMA PET is definitely better imaging staging, but there are limitations. And from a urologist perspective, you hit on something that we see a lot, and it's those isolated rib lesions. And there's a lot of data now that's showing that it's okay to ignore those solitary PSMA positive isolated rib lesions. You know, I think that brings us into kind of the next discussion point that we wanted to talk about. And when you see this new patient with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, what is, you know, the current standard of care? Because there's a lot of evolving options in this space.
I mean, I think the least that we can do for these patients is testosterone suppression plus an ARPI, androgen receptor pathway inhibitor. Whether they need chemotherapy or not, that's a different story. The triplet therapy, we have two triplets that we can use, a combination of ADT plus abiraterone and docetaxel, or ADT darolutamide plus docetaxel in triplet combinations, which are approved now. But at least a combination of ADT plus ARPI if there is no major contraindication to that. And we have similar outcomes as far as the efficacy between abiraterone, apalutamide, enzalutamide, and recently darolutamide added to this combination, although it doesn't have FDA approval yet. The data is out there and shows promising results. So to the bottom line is at this age, I don't think ADT should be standard of care anymore. Doublet is the minimum. And the other point that I want to make here when you talk about standard of care, I think it's very important. I don't think ADT plus docetaxel is a standard of care anymore because we have two trials showing addition of ARPI, androgen receptor pathway inhibitor, to the backbone of ADT plus docetaxel is superior to ADT plus docetaxel. So if you want to give docetaxel, in my opinion, it has to be with ARPI plus ADT. And if you can give that systemic therapy, we have good tolerance to these ARPIs, and I think it should be considered for most patients, if not all.
Just to kind of push the point a little bit on PSMA PET, you know, most of the studies, the evolving landscape of studies that are being designed and executed on now do incorporate PSMA PET as kind of the primary staging modality. But most of the studies that we're going to talk about on this discussion used conventional imaging. So when we're talking about high volume disease, low volume disease, does someone have metastatic disease? I mean, if you have a patient that comes to you and they have, let's say, you know, a couple rib lesions, a sacral lesion, and then, you know, some retroperitoneal lymphadenopathy. So they've got four spots on PSMA PET, but not a single one of those is showing up on a CT or a bone scan. How do you kind of decide whether you're going to be treating that patient as someone who has metastatic disease or someone who's non-metastatic, biochemically recurrent? Because the treatment options available are really different in those two settings.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I don't think anybody has answered to this because the patient is the same patient. You just see the patient as metastatic or non-metastatic. And the data that we have is old data with conventional imaging. Honestly, it depends. In my practice, I rely a lot on PSMA, a PET scan, to use that to make decisions, especially in younger patients, fit patients, to actually be as aggressive as possible. Unfortunately, the staging can switch from, let's say, pelvic node positive, which we try to cure with concurrent ADT and radiation, to something that is now have retroperitoneal lymph node, and conventionally they're not curable anymore. But it's a very fine line to walk, and I don't have a clear answer for you. I think it's case by case, but they use a lot of PSMA data to make decisions, despite the fact that we don't have any major data for that.
Yeah, that highlights a big conundrum that we have, because if we go back to the late 90s, Dr. Pound's study in BCR prostate cancer showed that it took a median of 8 years on biochemical recurrence to seeing metastasis on conventional imaging. And so now, when we find somebody who has mets on PSMA PET that may even be high volume, but conventional imaging is negative, we're finding them somewhere in that 8 year period. And it's going to take a while for us to accumulate the data and experience to really know what it means. But I think, by and large, in most people's practices, we're taking the PSMA PET data for face value and treating them based on that information. And from the current standard of care, if I could summarize what you're saying, is that ADT is not as a monotherapy standard of care anymore. ADT and docetaxel is no longer a monotherapy standard of care options. And if you're going to use docetaxel, it really needs to be in combination with an ARPI. And then the other standard of care option would be the doublets with ADT plus an ARPI. And I think that brings us into our next question with, you know, how are you treating these patients? And really, it gets into how do you make a decision between that doublet or triplet combination therapy, and really what drives your decision-making process?
I can talk about what we know and what we have now. And I admit, before we go in there, that these definitions are not perfect and nowhere close to other cancers are. For example, breast cancer and what we know about the behavior of the disease versus prostate cancer, we talk about volume, like high volume, low volume, or high risk, low risk, dependent, you know, the latitude had high risk, low risk, the charted defined high volume, low volume. But overall, these are not molecular based. They're not super scientific, but that's what we know. And, you know, that's how much we can rely on the behavior of the disease by counting the number of lesions and so forth. So for me, there are a few things that I do. One is to look at the molecular profile. I almost do an NGS on every single patient. If I see P10 loss, P53, or RB loss, then those are the patients that I think probably going to benefit more from the chemotherapy. Then the next point is to look at the clinical presentation. Do they have pain? Do they have liver lesion? Do they have high volume disease? Do they have high risk disease, for example? But right here, I'm just going to say the high risk, high volume for the most part overlaps. So it doesn't matter which criteria you use, but either or is okay, whatever you're comfortable using. I can talk about the definition of both. But yes, I mean, there's a molecular part, the PSA kinetics, and then the other part is the clinical behavior of the disease. For the most part, young patients, high volume, liver met, pain, those are the patients who get chemotherapy in combination with ADT and novel hormonal therapy or ARPI.
And what type of...
I can emphasize that this, if I may just make it clear, in my practice, I use two regimen in triplet setting, whether with abiraterone docetaxel ADT or darolutamide docetaxel ADT. And I know that there's some data with enzymet that they use early docetaxel after enzalutamide and ADT, sorry, with early docetaxel, but that's not my practice. I normally use the two other for certain reasons. I mean, one is that there was no overall survival with that approach in that trial. So for whatever reason, is it drug-drug interaction or whatever it is, I rather use the data that we have with overall survival.
And so when it comes to kind of choosing not just which patients you're going to be offering triplet therapy to, but which of the, you know, better proven triplet therapy options to use, I mean, abiraterone is traditionally, at least in the urology community, thought of as a little bit of a harder drug to keep patients on, more adverse events, more drug-drug interactions, fewer patients that can get on it and stay on it. But what's your approach and kind of what's your experience been in terms of which patients you select for which regimen? And then also kind of what you talk to patients about in terms of what they can expect while they're on treatment.
Yeah, so that's a very good question because there are two parts to it. You know, what actually you have upfront as far as the drug-drug interaction goes. Both drugs are safe. We know that from the trials, but darolutamide is known to have the least amount of drug-drug interaction with other drugs that this patient may be on. So that's a very important point. And abiraterone is not too bad compared to some of the other agents that we have as far as the drug-drug interaction. But I like darolutamide a lot. And the reason for that is that one is prednisone-free. And some of these patients have diabetes. They get weight gain over time. And they complain about not being able to sleep. So let's keep in mind that when you use the triplet, these patients stay on the ARPI for a long period of time after. And this is a cumulative toxicity that we have to think about the quality of life for these patients when we choose between the two. I use both triplet regimens, but for the most part, I use darolutamide in combination with. And then I tell you one situation that I use is for patients who have very low GFR. And I'm more comfortable using abiraterone in those patients who are really close to dialysis or so. So if I have to give docetaxel, I combine it with abiraterone with those patients.
I also find, so in my practice, I don't do the docetaxel, but I do all the other drugs. And one of the categories of patients that we do kind of wind up using a heavier amount of the abiraterone on is patients who are really of limited financial means, because the fact that it's generic, the fact that you can go ultra low dose if you have them change up their diet a little bit, kind of gives you a little bit more optionality in terms of keeping patients on treatment. And that's been helpful for me. But I totally agree. I really like darolutamide for the tolerability profile, and that's what the majority of my patients are on.
It's a little bit easier this year. Sounds like Medicare has changed some of the rules as far as the payment, the copay and all that. I find it less challenging this year. So we'll see what happens. But it's only 2 months into the year. We'll see.
Yeah, there's a lot of changes. So I'm not a fortune teller for this one. We'll see what the year brings.
And I think from a urologist perspective, something like darolutamide is going to be easy. We're going to see more and more urologists treating patients in this space. And, you know, we're not trained in a medical oncology fellowship. And so sometimes it's learning on the fly. And sometimes the drug-to-drug interactions may scare people that aren't as familiar with what they need to be worried about. Or they may just be worried and they don't need to be worried, but the lack or decreased amount of drug-to-drug interactions, I think, is really attractive from a urologist perspective. And then also just not needing the prednisone, I think, is another big point for darolutamide and for the simplicity's sake for urologists, who I think will probably have a bigger role in this space as we get more and more patients with MHSPC.
And I think, I mean, it's, I totally agree. I think we're going to see more and more urologists. I mean, in the large urology group practice world, it's very, very rare for a large urology group at this point not to have at least an advanced prostate cancer arm, if not an advanced cancer arm in general, and doing immunotherapy infusions. And I think that's really important, because the data, even as recently as 5 to 7 years ago, was that the majority of men who died of prostate cancer were never on anything other than just baseline androgen deprivation. And abiraterone was a massive step forward when it came out, but I think it scared off a lot of community urologists. And as we see more and more drugs like apalutamide and darolutamide that are just really well tolerated, and yes, you have to monitor closely, but they're easier to administer, I do think that you're going to see a greater role for urologists in the space.
If I may say something here about addition of chemotherapy, let's make it clear. We really don't know how much chemotherapy adds to the combination of the ADT plus ARPI. We know ARPI adds the combination of ADT plus docetaxel, but not vice versa. So there are two ongoing trials. One is Aspire, and the other one is with apalutamide, basically. So the thing is, we treat the patients upfront and consider early docetaxel for sort of patients that we know higher risk by NGS. As I mentioned, TP53, these are stratified by these findings, one or two or three risk factors as far as NGS goes. And the other one is actually looking at the PSA response. The patients who don't get less than 0.2, then they randomize to get early chemo or not. So we're sort of getting there, but as I said, we're not nowhere close to breast cancer and other cancers that we treat. We're trying.
So I guess that kind of brings us to our next point. So when let's fast forward and say, in theory, that darolutamide were to get an FDA approval, so you have your choice between abiraterone, enzalutamide, darolutamide, apalutamide. All of these are FDA approved options upfront for a patient with de novo metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. Can you kind of share your experience comparing and contrasting between the four different drugs and talk a little bit about how you choose between the four of them?
If I may, I'm going to go straight to ARANOTE, and because that's the data set that we have in sure. combo. And, you know, simply, in my opinion, the efficacy of these drugs are very similar, whether it's abiraterone, apalutamide, or enzalutamide. But when it comes to play is really the side effects of these drugs. And we look at the ARANOTE and look at the side effect profile. And, you know, the rate of discontinuation is higher in placebo compared to the combination. So it gives you two points. One is that the combination of ADT plus darolutamide works better, and that's probably why a patient can stay on it for a longer period of time for better disease control. And let's keep in mind, about 70% of these patients were high volume, high risk. So there were not just tiny metastases and all that. So better control of the disease and better tolerance compared to placebo comes from disease control, in my opinion, more than anything else. So very well tolerated drug, and, you know, effective. At least we have the PFS data from ARANOTE And we don't have the OS, but it looks promising and is still in the favor of darolutamide plus ATD. We'll see when the data is mature, but I'm very excited about that because it really met all the secondary endpoint and primary endpoint, and OS is not mature, as I said, but PFS is positive. So efficacious and tolerable. I really like to use darolutamide more than other agents for the reasons that I mentioned before: drug-drug interaction, tolerance, and efficacy, all of that.
What has your experience been like with the other ones? I mean, apalutamide, enzalutamide, we've talked a bit about abiraterone. But...
yeah, there's a little bit of concern for me as far as the mental fatigue goes with enzalutamide and apalutamide both. And these elderly population able to function just fine until they get to the ARPIs, and you know, sometimes it really interferes with their daily activities, and that's very concerning. As you expand their lifespan, then you think about the quality, and that it's not there. Fortunately, darolutamide is a little bit different from a molecular design standpoint, and it doesn't get to the brain, to the CNS, cannot pass the blood-brain barrier as well as the others. It does some, but it's not as much. So these patients stay more clear as you deal with that. And I think that that's a very important point when I look at it. Rash is another concern. It can happen with darolutamide, but nowhere close to apalutamide, which is about 25% or so. Even, you know, sometimes you have to get the patient off the medication altogether because they cannot tolerate the drug. So these are some of the concerns, some of the main ones. But, you know, I think the mental fatigue is a big one for me. And the fatigue itself, actually, in my opinion, is better compared to the others. I mean, I don't want to go across the trials, but that's my practice when I use this and, you know, think about which one could be better tolerated as far as the fatigue goes. I mainly go with darolutamide.
You know, in this trial, in the ARNO trial, you know, certainly there was a survival advantage compared to ADT plus placebo. And I think that's a point to make. This may be the last trial that we get where we can compare to ADT plus placebo. It may be that future trials are going to need to compare ADT plus one of the handful of APRIs that we have. But certainly it was better. And I think it was fair to say consistent with the treatment results that we see with these other drugs. And from a safety perspective, at least as good, if not better than the other approved drugs in the space. And I think it's likely, now tell me if I'm wrong, but I think it's likely that these results are ultimately gonna lead to approval and use. Do you see any barriers? You know, one of the issues is we now have multiple options and physicians are sometimes creatures of habit and click the same button that they order an Epic or whatever it may be. Do you see any barriers to implementation, or do you think that doctors are going to uptake use of darolutamide quite quickly?
I'm really hopeful that they do. It's an easier drug for this elderly patient population. That's very important, in my opinion. I think as oncologists, we learn, we adapt, and you know, we go with easier or more effective treatment. So I hope if it gets approval, then I think it should be easy to get adapted by physicians. Yeah.
And I can say from a kind of community practice standpoint, apalutamide is incredibly well tolerated by patients compared to some of the other ones, but the rash is a real problem. And a lot of patients don't call in until the, you know, they don't call in when it's a small spot. They call in when all of a sudden it's covering half of their torso. And at that point, it's a lot harder to get it to go away. So being able to have the option with darolutamide would be nice. The one problem that I see is that, I mean, there's a reason that this trial had to be conducted ex-US because the FDA was not going to provide ethical approval for a doublet combination that was versus placebo plus ADT. And there's a reason why there's a lot of countries that don't usually heavily enroll on trials that heavily enrolled on this, because it was a way for patients to get access to drugs that they otherwise had absolutely no way to get access to. And, you know, even just getting access to free ADT was a big step forward for them. So I'm very, very hopeful that this does lead to an approval in the U.S. But it's not a sure thing. The FDA does not often grant clearance based off of ex-U.S. studies with zero patient data from within the United States. And there's examples even within urology. I mean, in the bladder cancer world, Patapsco is being conducted because Potomac was ex-U.S. and the FDA said you need more patients. So, you know, I hope it does get approved, but it's certainly not a slam dunk yet, unfortunately.
I agree. And to be fair, give the credit to the to people who conducted the trial. It was a 2-to-1 randomization, so at least two patients got combo, one got ADT. But to your point, even free ADT is a lot some places. So we hope to have these options available to our patients if FDA gives us approval. I think patients who have used darolutamide in other setting would be ready to use it in metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. And the rest of them hopefully continue to learn about the newer agents and switch practice. I think this is a great drug. It really is. And I solely talk about quality of life and tolerance, falls, fatigue, and other issues physically with these patients.
So there's also, you know, a lot of new trials coming down the pipeline, both in the hormone sensitive, which is primarily that pipeline's primarily moving up drugs that are approved in the castrate resistance setting. But then there's also a lot of new mechanisms of action that are coming down the pipeline for metastatic castrate resistant prostate cancer. So there's the radioligands, you've got EZH inhibition. You've got AR degraders that are coming down the pipeline, CDK4/6 inhibitors. Are you keeping tabs on any of these, or are there any that you're particularly excited about?
Yes, I do. I think everything you said is important. We still continue to explore. CDK4/6 really didn't pan out as much as it did in breast cancer. It wasn't that robust, the data. I think it's because of the RB loss down the road for these patients who are in castrate-resistant setting, and we really can't use these agents as much as we use in breast cancer. PARP inhibitors has been ongoing forever. I think one of the reasons that I test everybody, NGS, for that is to have that option in case they're eligible for that. I do not believe that it's for everybody. I believe that PARP inhibition is good for patients who have the PARP biomarker. And what that biomarker is a long discussion is which one. And there might be some of these PARP biomarkers we don't even know how to test for. That's a good possibility. So we continue to explore. And that's why I say PARP biomarker negative patients benefit from this. It doesn't make any sense, but the sense of it is like we don't know what to test for. They're actually positive. We just call them negative. So these are all possibilities, but I think biomarker-driven work needs to be there for PSMA lutetium, for example. We have a biomarker, which is our PET scan, to look at the target and see if these patients may or may not. And we know some of those SUVs and the mean, for example, is important in some of these patients. So actually, that's what we know, that it works as far as the prediction of the response for these patients. And I think radioligand targeted therapy is important. I think BiTE therapy is coming nicely, and Amgen has got a few trials on that, talking about the T cell engagers, CAR T cell. Who knows? Maybe it pans out as well. So it's not for everybody. I think for younger patients who be able to tolerate these heavy duty treatments, we have some of the options because we all know we've been all there for patients who still look very good, but they're running out of the options, that you have used all the bullets and there's nothing else to give them. So hopefully these type of treatments, which are not tolerable to everybody, will be good for some of these patients to hopefully put them in long-term remission, for example, using immunotherapy and such. So I would say use the NGS, think about it. As I said, it could be predictor of response to some agents, and also prognostic in other ways to look at the higher risk patients. So, and then as far as the immunotherapy with checkpoint inhibitors, there are very minor patient population with Lynch, for example, that may MSI high may benefit from these type of agents as well. But yeah, the research is evolving. We have a couple of trials with MPI for CYP11 inhibition, which works basically your AR degraders. All these agents work after one line or two lines of therapy with other agents as far as ARPIs goes. So a lot going on, and we continue to work to make it easier for patients to tolerate it and make them live longer, hopefully.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting in the metastatic hormone sensitive setting as these things move up, because right now, as you said, a lot of the trials are in heavily pre-treated patients. They don't have a ton of options that are left to them, and the trial designs are very specific that they have to have seen, you know, X novel hormone therapy plus minus chemotherapy before they're even eligible. But trials like Amplitude are bringing PARP up into the metastatic hormone sensitive space. The other ones are going to start marching up there eventually. So whereas right now our big decision is doublet or triplet, and which of the novel hormone therapies should we use for the doublet? If we put the double, even if we put the doublet triplet question to bed, and let's say it's just doublet, then it's okay. Is it doublet plus PARP, doublet plus EZH inhibition, doublet? You know, it just, the questions are going to keep coming, and I think we're going to stay in a place where a lot of times we're having to extrapolate based off of scant data and kind of compare across trials, which is fraught with its own issues. So it'll be an interesting world.
So what I tell my patients, my job is to keep you alive with good quality of life until the next treatment hit the market. So, and I can still give it to you. So yeah, we were very hopeful that what we do now results in significant overall survival for our patients. And hopefully, who knows, one day or wish is curing all these patients. We'll see.
Well, as urologists, we hope that PSA screening prevents our patients from ever meeting you in the medical oncology clinic. You know, we just talked about a lot of interesting data and fun treatments. You know, GU ASCO 2025 just happened, and Aeronaut just published their subgroup analysis looking at high and low volume disease. I'm just wondering what your take on was from that subgroup analysis.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, as I said, high volume disease was about 70% and low volume was 30%. But regardless of that, patients benefited with progression-free survival, patient benefited with all secondary endpoint, time to castration resistant, time to next line of therapy. So there was no difference between the two. And the tolerance was about the same. It wasn't like high volume patients were sicker and didn't tolerate it well. So everybody, all comers really benefited from this. And there was another presentation by Fred Satt talking about Aerosense and use of triplet in younger versus older patients. 75 was the cutoff. And they showed that there was no difference between younger and if you have a fit patient, age doesn't matter. Just go for it. So these are important points to think about these subgroup population that benefit from the treatment, regardless of their volume, regardless of age for the triplet.
Well, and I think it dovetails into something that you said earlier about Aeronaut, which is that patients on darolutamide did better because they stayed on treatment and they saw, you know, fewer symptoms, fewer side effects, and they saw their disease improving. So they stayed on longer, because the subgroup analysis from the triplet therapy, you're totally right. I mean, the effect size was very similar between the two groups, but you saw the duration of therapy be longer in the under 75 crowd. And that's probably, I mean, my interpretation is that's probably just they tolerated it better. They have more reserve. They could stay on therapy longer. And I think that the data across every trial has borne out that the longer you can stay on therapy, typically the better you do.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. Yes. So again, if I see a patient who can tolerate the chemotherapy and they're fit for chemotherapy, I won't be hesitant to use the triplet, especially with the darolutamide, which is a very well-tolerated agent. Yeah.
Well, we've had a very fun conversation today. I think the last question I would leave you with is just if you could predict what advancements we're going to have in clinical care over the next 1 to 5 years, what do you think is going to be most impactful for our patients?
I think given triplet, quadruple therapy upfront, when I added fourth part of it is inclusion of radiation therapy to the care of these patients. For oligometastatic disease or low volume disease, let's not forget that we can radiate the sites of metastasis. We can radiate the primary site as well. And there are ongoing trials for these patients to get prostatectomy to see if these are going to be helpful in long term for these patients. For example, the GU toxicity, bleeding and all that. So hopefully we see less and less symptomatic patients who are really suffering from progression in their pelvis or cord compression and all that down the line. But I think more upfront therapy, and maybe for a shorter period of time, rather than keeping the patients on therapy forever. We have done one trial, EDREAM, that is 18 months of combination of ADT plus ARPI. We'll see how it pans out. Can we get them off the therapy, stop everything, and just monitor this patient? Those are very important questions to be answered. Can we get the patients off therapy with upfront heavy treatment? When I say heavy, it means that, for example, radiation, ARPI, and ADT, plus minus docetaxel and whatnot. So more therapy upfront, better control of the disease, and maybe off therapy for longer period of time.